From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Today, the Breakroom Gang is going to tackle the NFL's policy on kneeling during the national anthem. They'll also look ahead to a historic governor's race here in Georgia. That's ahead this hour. But first, this week we talked with Emory University professor George Yancey, who argues in his latest book that white people must talk about the ways that they benefit from racism.
You're raising the issue for me more specifically of the concrete expressions of white supremacy. And I don't mean the Klan in this case. I mean everyday white people who consider themselves to be God-loving people.
Here are your first thoughts. Al Effendi tweeted, "Professor George Yancey is as brave as he is intelligent as he is righteous." Well, listeners, we always want to know what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to Facebook, and we might feature your comments on the show. Well, as you know, Celeste Headlee was the host of this program for a long time, actually since the program started a few years ago. Since she left a few months ago, I've been hosting a lot. Tony Harris, Leah Fleming, we've all been filling in for Celeste Headlee. But thankfully, this program will have a new rock-solid, every single day, going steady host starting next week. And her name is Virginia Prescott. She was formerly the host of the local show Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio, but you might know her better as the host of the insanely popular Civics 101 podcast from New Hampshire Public Radio. I can tell you, listeners, as you may have learned from listening to me talk all this time on this show, I'm sort of an expert in the public radio business. It's what I cover. It's what I do as a journalism professor down here at Mercer. And Virginia Prescott is really, really well known in our field and very, very well respected. And you are very, very lucky to have her. So let's talk to her now and find out her deal. Welcome, Virginia.
Hello there.
Why are you moving to Georgia?
Because it's Georgia. Everything is happening in Georgia right now. I think, actually, Georgia's probably like one tick ahead of the rest of the nation. So I think it's a really good place to be.
Okay. What did you think when you got the call that we wanted you to host this show?
I was shocked and surprised and absolutely exhilarated. I'm so excited to be here. For one, I must admit, I do have a boyfriend in Atlanta.
Ooh. Can you tell us anything about him?
Yes, I can. His name is Matt Arnett, and he runs a listening space here in Atlanta called Grocery on Home. But his family has, for many years, been collecting vernacular Southern African-American art. So many people in the art world may know them. And Matt also hosts the open mic every Monday at Eddie's Attic.
Eddie's Attic. That's incredible. In Decatur.
Yes.
That's fantastic. I know a few things about moving from New England to Georgia. I did it myself, though I am not a native New Englander. I moved to Macon from Boston. You're moving from New Hampshire, and you're born and raised in New Hampshire. How's the transition working out so far?
Oh, my gosh. I love it. I really love it. First, one, we had a really wet and cold spring. There were melting snowbanks just until I left pretty much New England. But also, I just love there's so much here. And I have to say, the coffee has been one of the biggest surprises. Really good coffee. Everywhere. Yeah. Did you ever see that movie, The Lost Weekend? You know,
no.
When he, well,
and I also don't drink coffee, so drop this knowledge on me.
Okay. Well, in The Lost Weekend, he's trying to dry out. There's I forget the actor. It might be like Ray Milland, but it's a, you know, black and white film. And he's trying to quit drinking, and he's walking around on the streets, and he sees these neon signs of like martini glasses and strip clubs, all the vices. And that's what it's like for me coming through Atlanta, because everywhere it feels to me like there's big, blaring coffee signs, and there's a lot of opportunity to become over-caffeinated on really good coffee.
Well, being caffeinated is a good thing to do as the host of a morning show. How familiar were you with this program prior to applying to be its host?
Well, I've been listening for a while just because I've been visiting Atlanta for about a year. But I've also been, you know, I've been working at New Hampshire Public Radio for 10 years, really loved the job, but was getting that itchy feeling like it was ready to move on. I was ready to move on to the next thing. And even though we'd started these podcasts, Civics 101, and we also did one called the 10-Minute Writers Workshop, which were interesting and exciting, I felt as if I wanted a little more grist for the mill, more material than I could find in New Hampshire, which is a really interesting place. And as every place, you know this, Adam, every place, there are stories everywhere and
sure.
Interesting stories to look at. I felt like Celeste Headlee had become a kind of, you know, partner in crime, an entree into the culture of Georgia, because she was looking at so many different things beyond just the headlines. And that is, I think, an important way to know a place beyond the headlines.
If you're looking for grist for that mill, let me tell you, we're chock-a-block with grist around here, whatever grist is. I don't really know. But so you have lived in the South before, so this is not all alien country to you, right?
Right. I lived in New Orleans for 5 years when I was in my 20s. And you know, I know the South is not, you know, everybody's not flying the rebel flag, right? Obviously. Yeah. But I didn't know just how deeply, and I'm going to say fearlessly, the new generation was questioning and challenging some of the ideas that they grew up with. I mean, you know this, Adam, like, I feel like the things that influence our life are often the things that we don't choose, right? It's where we're born. It's the family that we're born into.
Yeah.
And everything just seems normal to us. We don't start to make choices until we experience more of the world. And it may be because now there's a generation of digital natives who have grown up with access to the whole world at their fingertips. So they're questioning a lot of the assumptions that they grew up with. And that's what I think is interesting about the South right now. These questions of legacy and history and heritage are being challenged. And I think that's a really interesting place to be.
I'm speaking with Virginia Prescott. She is the new host of this program on Second Thought here on Georgia Public Broadcasting. She's going to take over the show full time next week. She's coming to us from New Hampshire Public Radio. How's life in Atlanta so far? You like that traffic? I say that snickeringly from down here in Macon, where quality of life is much better, if I might say so myself.
Well, you know, that was true in New Hampshire. We couldn't have had a traffic jam if we'd scheduled it. And it is, it's funny that when you're talking to people, that is one of the things that they're scratching their heads about or just complaining about all the time. It really does change the way someone looks at the world when you have to think about the traffic between here and there. And here's the other thing. I brought a Vespa with me. I do have a car, but I drove a Vespa around in New Hampshire a lot. I love it, but a lot of people have warned me off of it here in Atlanta because people don't drive very courteously, but that's been...
Oh, you'll be fine.
It's been one of the great things, though. Driving around in a Vespa, you see the world differently because you're aware of your surroundings in a much different way. And plus, it smells fantastic. And it's a great way to wander around. Like last night, we went to the Golden Hour. It's an installation of art at the Oakland Cemetery. And then we went to get something to eat. And we were passing by the New School, and they had a reception. There are just so many things going on in any given block. There's so many things to wander into. Mm-hmm. That's just thrilling.
You say it smells fantastic. I gather you don't mean the exhaust. You mean perhaps the magnolia trees?
When you're especially driving around at dusk, you can smell the magnolia trees and all of these smells that come hitting you block by block. Yeah, it's not the exhaust. It's the foliage.
Well, I tell you, a lot more months of the year, you're going to be able to ride that Vespa around here.
That's true. That's one of the things I'm looking forward to.
So how did you get into this line of work?
Well, I started, I'm actually, to give you a little bit of background, I'm one of 11 children. And I know, yeah, that doesn't happen a lot these days outside of, I don't know, the farm belt. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But so I'm one of many. And so there was a lot of conversation going on in our household and a lot of sort of trickle down and a lot of curiosity, I think, about how the rest of the world lived. And I was an English major. I wanted to write. And when I came to New Orleans, derailed meandering trip to San Francisco, and we ran out of money just about in New Orleans, so I ended up there. But I did have this belief that stories and hearing stories and ideas and the experience of other people can influence us and change us in, you know, sometimes subtle and sometimes really profound ways. And in New Orleans, especially, where sound was so alive, the music is the language of the city, and you could hear it in the way that people talked, and you could see the rhythm in the way that people walked. And listening to this community radio station where I started, WWOZ, it just felt like a real connector, and I started volunteering there and eventually got a job.
And when you started in community radio in New Orleans, you were not a host. You were the operations manager, which is like a behind-the-scenes technical position. How did you start getting on the mic?
Well, I'm going to say at a small station like that, operations manager means you do a little bit of everything. And you do a lot of filling in when people don't show up for their shifts. But what it did teach me is a lot about rendering sound, about recording it, and about getting the best possible sound and to use sound to create a story. You're right, it wasn't until I left there and I went to WNYC in New York that I started actually making radio behind the mic as a reporter initially. And then I got all into digital media because at that time it was all new, that this possibility of changing the way that we listened. You know, radio used to go out into the ether and kind of disappear. But suddenly people could listen to it again and interact with it and comment back. And that was the beginning of a changing of the dynamic of the top-down radio from, you know, the authoritative broadcast voice to people actually creating their own response to what they heard and changing the whole conversation of media.
You had a period in Africa. You worked in Sierra Leone for a while?
I did. I actually, before Sierra Leone, I worked in Burkina Faso, Niger, Senegal, Mali, worked in South Africa some. And in West Africa especially, there hadn't been a very strong journalistic tradition. You know, people, there was the state-owned radio, there was the state-owned television, and basically people who were reporting, they were like a stenography pool. You know, the government makes an edict, you write a story about it. So I was there with Fulbright-Hayes project to train journalists in creating stories and creating journalism that was a little that stuck more to the sort of principles of integrity and reporting that had not been a very strong tradition. But when I was in Sierra Leone, that was after 11 years of an absolutely brutal civil war. And part of the problem was that information was not dispersed across the country in a strong way because they didn't have any infrastructure. So we were actually trying to create a radio network and trying to prevent information being owned, let's say, by a small group of people who could influence the population and do some pretty destructive things. It was an amazing experience.
Having that experience in your backpack, how does it feel looking at the state of American media today?
Well, I think that the principles are the same, that access to good information helps people make good decisions. And if you have good factual information and you get context for the things that are coming out of the world politically and culturally, then you can make your own decisions. You can have your own interpretations of what's going on in the world. Really, it's the basics of a strong fundamental democracy, people knowing what is really going on so that they can make decisions and act on those.
All right, let's do a few quick vital stats with Virginia Prescott, new host of On Second Thought. Favorite food?
I'm going to say Jenny's ice cream.
We have that in Atlanta.
You do?
Yes.
I stood in a very long line to get some yesterday.
Yes, so good. So good. Favorite music?
Boy, that's a toughie. Well, I share, I think, some of your affection for soul and R&B music, Adam.
You're in the right place.
Yes, I used to write liner notes for, that was one of my first jobs in New York, writing liner notes for Sony's Rhythm and Soul series. So, I don't know, God, it's whatever I'm listening to at the time that I really like. I'm not a list maker. That's one of the things that I am not.
And finally, favorite book. What are you reading right now?
Lauren Groff's book, Florida, which I am just absolutely loving. It's got all of the kind of humidity and strangeness and, I guess, kind of questioning strangeness of living in a place, having a little bit of a perspective as an outsider, but seeing a place that where things go on that you just don't understand and eventually, I guess, you figure out.
Sounds relevant to your life experience at the moment.
Yeah, I guess I just don't know if I'm ever going to quite figure things out. And maybe that's not a bad place to be as a radio host.
Not at all. We're here to bring the questions, not the answers, right?
Right.
That's Virginia Prescott, host of On Second Thought, the new host of this program. She's going to start full time next week. And we're getting her from New Hampshire Public Radio. And let me tell you, folks, we really are very lucky. This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. Coming up next, the incomparable jazz saxophonist Tia Fuller is playing at the Atlanta Jazz Festival, and we're going to talk to her. Stick with us. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusa. The Tia Fuller Quartet takes the stage at this weekend's Atlanta Jazz Festival. Fuller graduated from Spelman College with a music degree, and she's toured with greats like Beyoncé, Erykah Badu, and Janelle Monáe. She's currently a professor at the Berklee College of Music. Her new album, Diamond Cut, is now available. On Second Thought's LaRaven Taylor spoke with Fuller about her new album and her upcoming performance at our Atlanta Jazz Festival.
My name is Tia Fuller, and I'm a saxophonist from Aurora, Colorado. Currently, I'm living in Boston, Massachusetts, by way of New Jersey and New York. I come from a family of musicians. My mom is a jazz vocalist. My dad is a jazz bassist, as well as educators, both of them. And so grew up having music in my household, both music and education in my household, strongly valued. I went to college at Spelman College. Of course, just leaving my household as an 18-year-old young lady, going to Spelman, I realized that a lot of things were reinforced that my parents told me. So it wasn't just rhetoric. At the time, I might have thought it was rhetoric, but I was hearing echoes of their voices through not only my teachers, but also my peers and my friends. In the trenches, I literally sat erected from a very torrential, I guess you could say, time of feeling like I was at the bottom and emotionally. And of course, through the transition, the pressure and the temperature got kind of hot. So it was at that time where I wanted to write a song that reflected being able to feel like that you hit rock bottom, but figuring out a way that you dig yourself out, that you can rise out of the pain or rise out of discomfort, whatever it is, that's where that title came from. In the Trenches is really what the title speaks is. I was literally in the trenches emotionally and digging myself to the top. Save Your Love for me is one of my favorite standards, and I wanted to celebrate Nancy Wilson and Cannibal Adderley's rendition. So I called Warren, and pretty much he came up with this version of Save Your Love for Me, this arrangement, in like an hour. And he was like, Tia, I got you. So he called me an hour later, and that was the arrangement, which is truly amazing that he's able to do it that quickly. I think it's more simple, and just being able to exhale. And that song, especially now that I'm listening, or I've listened to it a thousand of times, but also I'm starting to play it, like the purpose of the song, I think musically and sequentially, allows for the album to breathe, even though it's the second song, but it kind of provides a front and a back to In the Trenches, which is the first song.
Jazz musician Tia Fuller. You just heard In the Trenches and Save Your Love for Me from her new album Diamond Cut. You can enjoy her music at this weekend's Atlanta Jazz Festival. Details at gpbnews.org. Well, it's been another long week, so as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened. It's time for the break room.
We want people to be respectful of the national anthem. We want people to stand.
It's not just history for me. It's history for changing the face of what leadership looks like in America.
Harry and Meghan, I now invite you to join hands and make your vows in the presence of God and his people.
Well, here to talk about those stories and more are the Break Room Gang. This week, it's Arts ATL contributing writer Christine Alcosiba, Oglethorpe University student Caleb Logan, Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Willoughby Mariano, and Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
So, Stacey Abrams makes history this week by becoming the first African-American woman nominated by a major party for its state's gubernatorial race, which is, like, amazing that that just happened, hasn't happened before.
About time.
Abrams, yeah. Regardless of how you feel about this particular candidate, it's kind of crazy that that hasn't happened until now. Abrams defeated Stacey Evans in Georgia's Democratic primary Tuesday.
This is our moment. Chance to lift up Georgia. And if we fight, if we push, if we work, we will win.
So the whole Stacey versus Stacey primary dynamic was seen as a microcosm of a wider debate among Democrats about where they should take their party, kind of following Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016 and a lot of other things. And yet it ended up being almost no race at all. Stacey Evans got trounced. I'd really love to hear what everybody makes of this race and the outcome. What do you think, Hector?
Well, just generally, I think it'd be inspiring to have, you know, a progressive, well-educated woman. I mean, I don't even put African-American in front. I mean, I'm just saying a woman as governor. I think the state deserves it. I think the division, the separation between urban areas and the country is showing more and more. But I hope it happens.
That said, you know, Stacey Evans, a lot of people thought would have been perhaps a stronger general election candidate. I know from talking to Republican Party insiders in Georgia that they were scared of Stacey Evans and they're not as scared of Stacey Abrams. Caleb, does that affect how you think about the outcome of this primary?
I don't think so. I think that it still is representative of where I hope America is going, giving more voices a chance, especially on a statewide platform, even a national platform. And I think it remains to be seen exactly what Stacey Abrams can do for the state and for the party. But I'm really excited if this is a marker for where we're headed as a country.
Willoughby, what do you make of Stacey Abrams' enormous primary victory?
Well, I think that probably people are a bit frustrated, or I guess voters really did want somebody on the left, somebody who is a solid progressive, because I think there is a bit of cynicism about candidates that calibrate all too well to what they perceive to be, voter sentiment, you know, instead of actually saying what they mean. And I think we saw that in 2016. And it's going to be really fascinating. I'm kind of excited to see this race because I don't think anyone has tried this kind of strategy in the South. She's not going to be able to swing towards the center. That's just not going to be possible for her because she has taken such a strong stance.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a risky stance because I don't know if she can win in this kind of way with this electorate. But I'm really interested to see if the kinds of risks that she's taking will actually yield dividends, because that could be a hallmark. You know, that can be the vanguard of some sort of different way of politics on the state level.
Christine, what do you make of Stacey Abrams' strategy going into the general election? Do you think she can win? Do you think anybody can win the governor's office in Georgia, playing primarily to African Americans in rural areas and then generally to urban populations, which I think is fair to say that's what her strategy is, or at least as described just there by Willoughby?
Yeah, I mean, I think like so many people I know, I'm cautiously optimistic. I really hope that she can. I think Willoughby's really onto something about, you know, at least as a progressive myself, I think we're looking for someone who's going to swing to the left, who's really going to take that route. And I think that nationally, we'll be looking at this particular run as a benchmarker for the midterms, right, for the rest of the year. I think other Democrats across the country are trying to see if this strategy is going to work. And I really hope that it does. I'm cheering for her.
It sure is a race that got a lot of national attention. Abrams, her campaign, got tons of out-of-state donations. There was lots and lots of coverage in national publications. What do you make of that, Hector? How does it feel to have your state politics coming under the national gaze like that?
I think Georgia, they're looking at Georgia because, in a sense, we're like a little lab, right? The rest of the country is realizing the South is changing. The demographics of the South are changing radically. And regardless of the fact that Stacey Evans had a lot more money, Abrams came through. So if it happens once within the Democratic Party, it's going to be really interesting to see what it happens when she has to challenge the opposition.
Before we leave the topic of the governor's race, let's look over to the Republican side. We're now going to get a runoff, as was pretty easy to predict, between Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle and Secretary of State Brian Kemp. Willoughby, handicap that race for us. What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, my goodness. Handicap?
Please handicap it.
Folks are saying Casey Cagle, but they're also saying that Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams really want to mix it up. So I take no, I'm not certain. I'm not a political reporter. I'm an investigative reporter. But, Cagle's, what the conventional wisdom says, is going to happen. And, it's going to be an interesting race.
Anybody else have insights into the Republican side there?
It's anybody's guess. Politics are so wild right now. Who knows? Yeah. You really can't say.
Right.
All righty. Well, we'll see, and we'll enjoy watching the campaign ads in the interim. Okay, let's talk about another African-American woman who's made history this week. Janet Jackson accepted the Icon Award at the Billboard Music Awards. So Janet Jackson is the seventh artist to win the Icon Award from the Billboard Music Awards, but amazingly, she's the first African-American woman to receive this prize, which is weird because when I think of people in popular music who are icons, I think like half of the people who come to mind are African-American women. Does this matter, or are we making too big of a deal out of this? What do you think, Christine?
Well, I have to admit, Willoughby and I chatted about this a little bit before the show came on, and she did mention to me that a fact that I didn't realize, which this award is only, I think it was only instituted in like 2011,
mm-hmm.
I think she was saying, so it's still relatively new. So I think that helped me to walk back my feelings of indignation about this news, because my first reaction to that was, of course, why not? About time, very similarly to how I felt about Stacey Abrams. But I think, given that context that it's less than a decade old, I don't know that it's more so much about race as it is maybe just, what's the word I'm looking for, Willoughby? Help me out here.
If you're giving an Icon Award in the last 7 years, how have you not given it to Beyonce yet?
How did they not give the Record of the Year to her last year at the Grammys?
They're starting kind of early in pop music history, it seems. And, this is as somebody who's relatively young saying this. So obviously the first award, I was ready to like get my pitchfork and hunt down all the evildoers who had not given Janet her proper due. And this is, and in eighth grade, I tried to get Janet hair. It didn't work. It was so awful. But the and expensive. But like they started off with Barry Manilow. So I think that if in 2011, so I think that if you're going to go back in history and get every, dig at the bottom of that barrel there and get out all the old school Billboard, chart toppers and try to line them up and give them their proper due in historical order, then you're kind of, then Janet can wait a little bit. This was a good time. As somebody who grew up, with Miss Jackson, if you're nasty, I'm willing to forgive a little bit. I'm 41. I'm old. So, yeah, I'm willing to let them catch up, for a little bit.
Hey, Caleb, you're currently a student at Oglethorpe University. I'm guessing you're relatively young.
Yes.
Janet's not had a super active career lately. What do the kids think about Janet? Do they still know Janet? Do they still love Janet?
The kids love Janet. I was just saying, Janet is in my top five of all time. Like, I love Janet Jackson. I was raised on Janet Jackson. So I think for a lot of people my age, it was like, it's about time Janet Jackson got some type of icon award or Video Vanguard award.
Yeah.
And I think we'll just have to see towards the future if they award more African-American women the icon award. Because I think, like you, when I think of icons in the music industry, over half of them are, you know, African-American women. So I hope they continue the trend.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. We're talking about the week's news here with the Break Room Gang. This week, it's Arts ATL contributing writer Christine Alcosiba, Oglethorpe University student Caleb Logan, Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Willoughby Mariano, and Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez. Happy Friday, everybody. Let's see. Starbucks now has an official open door policy. It's any customer is welcome even before they've bought anything. This policy change comes not long after two African-American men were handcuffed in a Philadelphia Starbucks by police because they had sat down before they had purchased anything. Here is Rashawn Nelson, one of the arrested men, speaking with ABC News.
Well, initially, as soon as they approached us, they just said we have to leave. There was no question of, you know, was there a problem here between you guys and the manager? You know, what happened?
So now the Starbucks policy is no purchase necessary. You can come in and sit down in our store before you've bought anything. Caleb, do you think Starbucks has put this incident to bed by making this change?
I don't think so. I think that Starbucks is in a tough spot because even in an acting policy, there's an inherent vagueness to it where franchises can read policy but still find a little wiggle room to kind of do whatever they want. So I was reading a little bit of the policy, and it has specific times when you should call 911 or call officials. But it was a little vague, as procedures usually are. So I think as long as we live in a climate, in a world where there is inherent bias, and that depending on where you are in the country, there's more bias, I think, you know, we'll continue to have incidents like we had a couple weeks ago. So, like I said, I think Starbucks is in a very tough spot. I don't know exactly what you can do as a corporation to kind of put something like this to rest.
Yeah.
I think this is a good start. They've done what they could do as a corporation. I'll just be tuned in trying to see where they go from here.
I suppose, Hector, that you could say that it wasn't the policy that was racist. It was the implementation of the policy. It was its application being disproportionately applied to two African-American men who weren't making a scene, weren't making a ruckus. They were simply waiting for their friend to show up before they bought their coffee.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, I think it has to do with the culture. The corporate culture has to be changed. There's a certain degree of sensibility that, you know, employees pretty much take from the administration. It's nourished down from the top. And if it doesn't come, things like this happen. I mean, we also had the event that happened in California with the guy writing beaner, you know, the term beaner on somebody's cup.
Which can be used as a epithet for a Hispanic person, right?
Correct. I don't blame the employees. I mean, it comes from the top. The employees reproduce a corporate culture, and that has to be changed. I don't know whether this policy change is really going to accomplish much. Personally, I happen to think that there are plenty of better other places to hang around and work, like public libraries. So, you know.
Shout out to library.
Yeah, Christine and Willoughby, team library or team Starbucks?
Oh, well, team neither, because I feel guilty about drinking coffee in a library because I'm afraid of like destroying all their books.
Point.
So I use my Joe's Coffee, my independent local neighborhood coffee shop as my little office outside the office.
Well, I have to cheer for Team Library. I'm a librarian by training, and we have a Pete's coffee in our library.
Yeah,
so I say, drink your coffee and enjoy your books, madam.
Exactly.
All right, let's move on to something really important. The royal wedding was this past weekend, and it attracted the world's attention. For months leading up to the wedding and even after it, the difference and diversity of the people getting invited and, in fact, participating in the wedding were favorite topics. Here is Episcopal Bishop Michael Curry speaking at the ceremony.
There were some old slaves in America's antebellum South who explained the dynamic power of love and why it has the power to transform. They explained it this way. They sang a spiritual, even in the midst of their captivity. It's one that says there is a balm in Gilead.
Okay, real quick. Take the opinion of the panel. Episcopal Bishop Michael Curry, rambling or nailed it? Who's on team nailed it?
Nailed it. I cried.
I cried, I laughed, I really enjoyed watching all of the British folks looking visibly uncomfortable in the church. And I think that was part of the pleasure of listening.
It felt like home. Great.
What would you say, Caleb?
I said it felt like home. It was really great.
Oh, nice. That's good. That's good. So according to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Michelle Obama and Meghan Markle, who got married there, can trace their families to the same Georgia town. Not only were their ancestors both Jonesboro residents, they also lived in Jonesboro at the same time. So the same Georgia town produced a first lady and now a royal. However, the AJC article doesn't mention why Meghan Markle and Michelle Obama's ancestors lived in Jonesboro to begin with. And that is, of course, because of slavery. Mm. Willoughby, since you work at the AJC, though you didn't write this article, what would you say to the charge that AJC is sort of skirting the issue there?
I know, the confirm nor deny, any willingness to skirt the issue. We actually do have some really great coverage on race, but I mean, isn't this an extraordinary moment? We have to confront our history in ways we never, you know, at least when I was a kid, I didn't think I would have to think about, you know, or at least the broader public would sort of acknowledge this kind of ugly history in our past and how it, you know, how it plays a role in our presence. So I'm very excited to see a royal basically with this kind of history.
Yeah, and it's striking that I think in America we tend to think of slavery as being an American sin, but it's just as much of a British sin, right? I mean, it was
absolutely,
and perhaps even more so.
Absolutely,
yeah, yeah. Caleb, what did you watch the royal wedding?
I did. I watched it after the fact, but I did see it.
Favorite part other than Episcopal Bishop Michael Curry killing it up there?
Just watching all the fashions. I loved almost every outfit, every hat. I loved that people were represented from all over the world with very different fashion choices. It was just a beautiful sight to see.
I'd have to second that, but then also say the choir rendition of Stand By Me was really, really beautiful, very special
gorgeous.
In that space.
I cried in that during that too, and I'm a mean person, so this is this
really?
Was yeah, oh, this is powerful.
All right. Well, speaking of Michelle Obama, the former first lady and her husband have reached a deal with Netflix. According to the company, Barack and Michelle Obama will produce a diverse mix of content, including docuseries, documentaries, features under the imprint Higher Ground Productions. So what do we think about this, Hector, of politicians getting an entertainment deal?
I don't see it as politicians. I see the Obamas they have deep knowledge and sensibility for a number of issues that are very relevant to the United States of America. So personally, I'll watch anything they're behind. You know, I think, well, Obama used to boast of the fact that he had a good talk, right? Well, he does have a good talk. I mean, I will watch whatever they produce.
Would anyone feel any differently if some notable Republican figures were given a large entertainment deal with an outlet like Netflix?
I'd like to pretend that I wouldn't, but I think I probably would. I have to admit, I probably think I would be less enthusiastic about, you know, Paul Ryan stepping down from politics and then all of a sudden working a deal with Netflix. But I think I think at this point the Obamas, I mean, for me anyway, for me personally, I feel like their presence and their contribution to the country is more than politics. It's deeply intellectual. It's deeply cultural. And I think I speak on behalf of the other writers of Atlanta when I say, how do we pitch something to this new production with them? I think it's fabulous.
Well, points for honesty. Caitlin, are you going to be watching?
Yes, I will definitely be watching. I think the Obamas for a long time have flirted with celebrity. They have always transcended politics, you know, hanging out with Beyoncé's and Kanye's and other things. So I think that this is a natural path for them. And like everyone else has said, they have always been highly intellectual, have had great things to say about both our country and the state of the world. So I would be very interested to see what they produce.
If you're just joining us, we're hanging out in the break room here on GPB's On Second Thought. We're talking about the week's news with Arts ATL contributing writer Christine Alcosiba, Oglethorpe University student Caleb Logan, AJC reporter Willoughby Mariano, and Georgia State University professor Hector Fernandez. Well, folks, the NFL has spoken.
We want people to be respectful of the national anthem. We want people to stand. That's all personnel. And make sure that they treat this moment in a respectful fashion.
That's Commissioner Roger Goodell announcing the new rules governing players' observance or lack thereof of the national anthem. Players will no longer be permitted to kneel during the national anthem without leaving themselves open to punishment or their teams open to punishment, facing possible financial penalties from the league. They will be allowed to stay in the tunnel, not come out into the field, if in fact that's what they'd prefer to do. But if they're on the field, they got to kneel or face sanction from the league. Willoughby, what do you make of how the NFL has played this?
Probably poorly. This is not a play I would have called because, you know, well, the fundamental issue is this. This is exactly what you get when you try to use patriotism as a, you know, it's part of your entertainment. People take their patriotism seriously. And this is exactly the kind of thing that people make bold stances on. I mean, think about Muhammad Ali. You know, we really care about how, you know, our citizenship, our country, where our country goes. You can't make it entertainment, or else you get this exactly this kind of problem. And this is not. I mean, because we're all going to be wondering, oh, who's in the tunnel? This is not going to make it any better for the NFL. It'll just create a new little sort of, you know, game and more, you know, embarrassments in spectacular new and fascinating ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think the league was in a bit of a no-win situation on this one from a PR standpoint. No matter what they did, they were going to make somebody angry. But Caleb, were you, like I was, surprised that they came down so heavily on the side of the kneeling is bad crowd? I thought they'd do something to make concessions to both sides here.
I actually wasn't surprised at all. I think they think the tunnel rule is a concession to the players who are kneeling. I think that people who are against the kneeling are a lot more vocal on social media, a lot more vocal in the news circuits. So they went to the side of the people who are more vocal. So I think now more than ever, it's time for players to support each other and take a larger stand together and really make a statement, because I do feel it's unfair. And I don't think that there was enough of a concession for the players.
Christine, what do you think happens next with all this?
You know, I think what happens next is exactly what Willoughby said. We're going to be thinking who's in the tunnel, who is being punished or pressured about their right to exercise the First Amendment as part of their practice. And that's a real shame.
Hector, do you think that the NFL has fixed this problem for itself?
I think it could backfire for them. This validates a very narrow understanding of civil liberties, and it affects freedom of speech. I can't help but think that they're pandering to a certain crowd. Mm-hmm. You know, soccer is coming in. And research already shows soccer is going one way in terms of class, and American football is going another. And I think they're trying to pander to a very specific crowd, but I think this is very dangerous.
All right. Let's try to sneak in one more topic before we have to wrap today. WSB-TV in Atlanta has a story about a Gwinnett County cosmetic surgeon who posted YouTube videos that show her dancing around and operating, dancing around the operating table with patients on the table. And the report says that some patients were left with unsatisfactory results, including brain damage. Lawsuits have been filed. One video shows a blurry image of a patient's backside while the surgeon sings and dances to this tune. This is an actual clip from one of the videos.
Booty, but you got a big booty, eat it, big, big booty, but you got a big
Wow. Okay. So, Caleb, what do you think should happen to this cosmetic surgeon?
Wow. Well, I mean, she left a patient, you know, brain damaged. So I just can't even imagine how the family feels, what that does to both the family and the person. So I think she should be tried to the full extent of the law. Like, you are a trusted medical official. Someone trusted their lives, put their life in your hand, and this is what happened. So I think that whatever, you know, punishments come her way, I think that she should be tried for them.
On the other hand, I feel like if any of us were videoed in the course of doing our jobs, people might see us doing things that wouldn't be all that flattering. I mean, no one likes to see how the sausage is made. That's a really unfortunate thing that I just conjured. I'm so sorry. Anybody want to argue that this is not a big deal?
No. Okay. This is horrible. It would have been funny if there was no naked rear end out there and she was not sort of getting ready to cut.
Yeah.
Right. I think it's also just, you know, we want to put a fundamental trust in our medical professionals,
exactly,
right? Yeah. They're responsible with our lives and our bodies. And it's not like I see a paper man, you know, dancing to that song and while he's delivering my paper. This is a surgeon. So
right.
So no, I don't make any concessions for this person.
All right. Well, we're out of time. Glad we ended on such a positive note. That was Arts ATL contributing writer Christine Alcosiba, Oglethorpe University student Caleb Logan, Atlanta Journal-Constitution reporter Willoughby Mariano, and Georgia State professor Hector Fernandez. Thanks, all. Have yourselves a great weekend.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
And thank you, listeners, for joining us. And thanks for joining me. This is sort of my last day hosting this show in the foreseeable future. As we just heard, Virginia Prescott, the new host of On Second Thought, is going to take over full time next week. I really want to thank everybody for their help in me doing this for the last couple of months here. My employer, Mercer University, for giving me the leash to spend a couple hours doing this every morning for a while. I want to thank all of the producers, Fenley Fox and Raven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, Summer Evans, Sean Powers, Don Smith, Tyler Morris, the engineer. You've all made it really, really easy for me to kind of roll out of bed and come into the Macon studio down here and do a couple hours of radio with y'all. I've really, really enjoyed it. And thank you, listeners. As Diamond David Lee Roth used to say, it ain't no fun without an audience. That's our show. We always want to hear from you. What do you think about Stacey Abrams' big win in the Democratic gubernatorial primary? What do you think about her chances in a general election against either Brian Kemp or Casey Cagle? Let us know. Give us a call, 404-500-9457, or you can post to Twitter. We're at OST Talk. On Facebook, you can just search On Second Thought Radio, and you will find us. Leave us a comment, and we might use it on the show. For On Second Thought, I'm Adam Ragusa. Have a good weekend.